Wahino amado na ilo heno alero uma sedero kono na alero uma sedero kono neu.
Shalom aleichem, beruchim abayim. Welcome everyone as we begin our commentary to Noah and the Ark. We're beginning with Genesis chapter 6, but I have a feeling we're probably going to go beyond that and possibly even cover the whole story here, taking us to the next following chapters. But we'll see as we proceed. Chapter 6 begins speaking about Noah being 500 years old, and he fathered three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefet. Yefet, even though, mind you, that he's mentioned last, is actually the firstborn. But aside from that, men began to increase on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them. The next verse says that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were good, and they took for themselves wives from whomever they chose. And immediately thereafter, God said, "My spirit will not continue to judge man forever. Since he is nothing but flesh, his days shall be 120 years. Continue, it says, the Titans were on the earth in those days, and also later. The sons of God had come to take the daughters of men and had fathered them. The Titans were the mightiest ones who ever existed, men of renown." Okay, in our last lesson, I introduced to you Noah. Noah is the 10th generation from Adam. He is the special chosen one. Obviously, we know the story of the ark and all that. He had three sons. Did he have other children? Don't know. Did he have grandchildren or great-grandchildren? Don't know. The story does not tell us those details. Nowhere do we have an authority that states he did not. Does that mean that he did? We don't know. But these are the prominent ones who were chosen, as we know, to be spared. Before we can get into discuss the flood, we have to discuss what precipitated it. Why did God all of a sudden say, "You know something? The earth stinks. Mankind is rotten. Let's flood them out"? That's a pretty radical course of action. What precipitated it? What became so evil that required such a radical response? Men began to increase on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them. It's an interesting teaching that's actually brought about this, that they said that when the original angels came down from heaven, because they had an argument with God. It's an age-old tradition that when God originally came to create man, a group of angels objected. Why? Why create him? He's only going to sin. He's only going to be weak. He's only going to fall. Let us go down to earth and repair that which man was being created to repair in the first place. And God said, if you ever went down there, you'd end up worse than they. They resented that. They never accepted that. God proceeded with his plan. One of their number subverted man in the Garden of Eden, we know, inhabited the serpent. The rest of these fallen angels, now we're waiting. Mankind at this time had mostly propagated males, and only had females enough to propagate the species. The fallen angels came to earth and said, "No, let us teach you genetic manipulation so you can have many daughters." And indeed they did. Now it says that these sons of God saw the daughters were good. They liked what they were creating, if you will, manipulating, and therefore chose not only to come to earth, but to stay on earth. Now here is something rather profound. We are under the impression that angels are these non-physical entities of light from some faraway dimension and universe. If that were the case, they would be as different from humanity as we are from slugs or snails. Now, let me ask you a question. When was the last time you dug up a slug or a snail in your backyard and said, "Wow, this is really sexy. I'd like to have relations with this and marry it"? Even the thought of that should put disgust into the belly of any normal, rational person. Oh, disgusting. But if these angels are so far removed and high above us, what on earth would possess them to be attracted to human females enough that they'd want to lose their status, couple with them, and come to earth. Now, I will share with you a very interesting take on this verse that I have only heard from an oral tradition from a very reliable source. Many years ago, there was a report in the media that they possibly found either the remnants of living microbes from some experiments on Mars. And in one of the local Jewish newspapers, they went around to ask all the different rabbis what they thought about the possibility of life in outer space. One of the rabbis whom they interviewed was Rabbi Aharon Soloveitchik. Rabbi Aharon Soloveitchik was the head rabbi of the Brisk Yeshiva in Chicago, mind you, a neighbor of mine at the time. He was also the brother of the head rabbi of Yeshiva University in New York, and I believe took that position after his brother passed away. Rabbi Aaron was quoted in the Jewish newspaper as referring to our verse here, and said, oh, life in outer space, of course there is. There are human beings in outer space. They are the sons of God, spoken of in chapter 6 here. And his source for this was a 9th century commentary written on the Bible, quoting even earlier sources. Human beings in outer space? Is that possible? Were these angels somehow like humans? I couldn't believe it. I never heard such a thing before. I was certain that the newspaper had misquoted or misinterpreted the rabbi. Now I said, I knew the rabbi. I actually, myself, was a rabbi in the Brisk Yeshiva where Rav Soloveitchik was the head rabbi. At the time, he was ill, so I did not bother to approach him directly. But I knew his two sons, Rabbi Moshe and Rabbi Eliyahu. I approached his son, Rav Moshe, himself a great scholar in our generation. And I said, Rav Moshe, one of these Jewish newspapers just featured an interview with your father claiming that he said something so radical as this. I'm expecting Rav Moshe to tell me that it was all wrong. But on the contrary, he said to me, no, my father did say that, and his source is from this 9th century text, and he does believe it. Based upon one of the leading rabbis of our generation saying this, I consider that to be appropriate authority to interpret this in that same light to you now. Apparently, these sons of God were angelic figures, but as recorded, interestingly, both Maimonides and in the Zohar, there are different races and levels of angels. And even though Maimonides, Rambam, expresses the non-corporeality, total abstract nature of angels, other sources disagree with him, some rather strongly. There are a race of angels in our physical world. Now, what is an angel? An angel just means a messenger, a representative of heaven. In all due respect, I am now serving as an angel, a representative of heaven, by teaching you the Torah. Each and every one of you are acting and serving as an angel, a messenger of heaven. Every time that you are acting and performing an act of loving kindness towards one another, providing support for those in need, and doing any other kind of deed and act, which obviously has its source in heaven. So therefore, for us to entertain the idea that we are not alone in our universe, an idea clearly documented in the works of our rabbis over centuries, and then to apply it here, especially within the bizarre context of what the verses are saying, apparently seems to be accurate. I believe it's one of the rules of the detective that after you have dismissed every other logical possibility. Whatever is left, however illogical it seems, in the end must be the truth. So when angels are to come down to earth, there must be a reason. It has to be some kind of an attraction. Why else would they have called the daughters good? But yet, when they came down to earth, something happened to them. Something changed within them. And essentially, what God had said to the angels originally, before the creation of man, was true. They did not have the ability to live life upon earth and maintain a semblance of righteousness or holiness. And by doing so, they became corrupted. And by their copulation with humanity, they polluted the gene pool and created a race of mutants who are here called Titans. And it's from this race of abnormal entities, this incongruent alignment of earthly and angelic nature, created a significant and serious imbalance that God Himself had to intervene into the genetic makeup of mankind, creating with us, if you will, a blemish in our DNA reproduction, which ultimately leads to the breakdown of our genetic code, which is the cause of our aging process, and ultimately and inevitably we died. Now, even though here the verse says God is limiting the life of man to 120 years, we see for literally almost another 10 generations people living far beyond that. So in essence, this was not an edict imposed upon mankind miraculously, all of a sudden no one lived beyond 120 years. We find even the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all living beyond that. Even Levi living beyond that. Indeed, it was only Moses who lived to 120. But even in his day, up until his day, I should say, there were many who lived way beyond those years. Now, this is the proper way of how we understand how God interacts with nature, the world He created, in accordance to the laws of nature that He Himself has ordained. Many of us carry the fantasy in our minds that God is like a fairy godfather, if you will, who waves his twinkly little magic wand and poof, everything happens. Well, if that were the case, He could have poofed an ark into creation. He could have poofed all the wicked people into their graves. Remember the plague of the firstborn in Egypt, where God walked through the land and smote the firstborn? He could have smote the generation of the flood. What's all the need with all the water? God has a ways and a purpose and a means to do things. That is the lesson we must understand here. Now, the Titans are on the earth. From the time that Enoch was born, and he lived only 365 years, we remember, until the days of the flood was almost 1,000 years. A lot of things happened in 1,000-year period. During this time, these Titans were here. This genetic mutation of angelic and human DNA combined. They obviously had their father's knowledge. And if an angel comes down here to earth, remember something. He is not God. He is not omnipresent and all-knowing. Like you and me, especially if an angel is more physical, he has to have some type of a vehicle of transportation, some means of an application of the laws of science, whether it's science of the mind or science of nature. In other words, these sons of God must have had some forms of technology and used them. And indeed, when we read the books of Enoch that we have discussed in our previous lessons, it states there that the angels came down to heaven and gave man gifts. gifts of knowledge. And the list of these gifts are today what we could call technology. And that is so profound in light of modern conspiracy theories which claim that aliens have been in touch with world governments and have given man gifts of technology. These theories are all over the place. There are books written about them. One by a very prominent military officer, a man who was in charge of security in the Pentagon, a Colonel Philip Corso, who wrote a book called The Day After Roswell, wherein which he outlines that he was in charge at the Pentagon, who saw the bodies of the aliens and reversed engineered the UFO craft and took the technology from there and spread it, salted it into the modern world today. His book is available. Interesting reading. True or false? What do I know? But I find it an interesting reflection in modern times of this ancient biblical teaching as well. Moving right along. Oh, as many of you from a Christian background would know, a term used in Christian apocalyptic literature is, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days before Mashiach. And those words echo in my mind when I make these correlations, wondering if the sins of the generation of Noah was because of the mutation of the gene pool, the introduction of foreign technologies. Is this what the days of Noah was like? And apparently now we have these similar types of accusations and conspiracy theories being made. If there's any truth to them, then that metaphor of application is certainly finding its way true today. The Titans of old were on those days. Who were they? You will find Josephus making a reference. These were the Greek gods of old. Zeus, Hera, Mercury, Apollo. These were the gods of Mount Olympus. Now, I think we can go to Mount Olympus today. I don't think we're going to really find much up there. But we have similar types of teachings in the northern countries, in the Norse traditions, of the gods of Valhalla, Odin, Thor, Loki. All of these human-type people who had supernatural, by our definition, powers, who came specifically and copulated with human females. Zeus took a human female and gave birth to Hercules. What Josephus is implying, and what the Torah here seems to be implying, is that there is an actual truth to these ancient mythologies. Just what plays out in truth and what is fiction, I could not tell you. But apparently, there is a foundation to these matters of ancient, not gods. We shouldn't call them gods any more than we can call ourselves gods because of our technological prowess. But I'm sure they would have wanted to look at themselves as such. I'm sure the human beings at the day who looked up to them for all the technological advancements and powers and abilities they had looked to them in that light. It was this series of interactions which caused terrible imbalance in the purpose of creation. God saw that man's wickedness on earth was increasing. Every impulse of his innermost thought was only for evil all day long. God regretted that he had made man on earth, and he was pained to his very core. Now, this is what I was telling you about. When the angels came down to earth, the negativity that somehow clung to them due to the adoption of the physical nature, created within them a completely reversed polarity from that which God originally intended. So it says, God saw man's wickedness. Which men? The men, obviously, who were these byproducts. Every impulse of his innermost thought was only for evil all day long. That's a pretty negative statement, isn't it? Good gosh, don't we have good thoughts sometime? a point that our commentators have made. They said that the reason why in the initial days man had such a long life was because God thought that over the period of hundreds of years that they would be able to ultimately learn from their mistakes, grow mature, and do what we call in Hebrew teshuvah, repent. We all know that the older we get, hopefully the wiser we get, and we look back at our younger days with regret because we said I wasn't smart enough to have known the difference. Well, here in these days, people had hundreds of years, almost 1,000 years. But instead of learning with wisdom to become better, they learned to become worse. They chose the path of the fallen angels, which themselves, remember, represented a concept of rebellion, an agenda of war against God. They came to say, we can run the world better than you can. And by them coming and adopting man and as if converting all of mankind to their agenda, thwarted the entire purpose of creation. Their whole ways and means of doing things. As it says, God was pained to his core, I will obliterate humanity that I've created from the face of the earth. Man, livestock, land animals, birds of the sky, I regret that I created them. It says Noah found favor in God's eyes. I just want to move ahead just a little bit. Continuing here, this begins actually in the Torah, the portion called Noah. These are the generations of Noah. He was a righteous man, faultless in his generation. Noah walked with God. The only other place in the Bible that was mentioned previous was with Enoch, and only later with Abraham. And indeed, a later commentator, Rabbi Bachia, states that this is a very unique term to describe a relationship with God, which is not based upon faith, but rather with knowledge. Enoch, Noah, and later Abraham all had experience of God. They were experts in awareness of the laws of science, the ways of nature, the movement of the stars, which means, if you will, how God operates his universe. And they were able to transcend, meaning see through all of that, to recognize the ultimate source being the one singularity of the universe, the Holy One, blessed be He. That was why Noah was chosen. He accomplished that. And it said here he had the 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now getting back to what we were talking about. The world was corrupt before God and the land was filled with crime. God saw the world and it was corrupted. All flesh had perverted its way on the earth. What kind of crimes? What was going on here? Well, by choosing to follow the path of the fallen angels, to trust in their technology and deny the singularity of God's rulership over the earth, the people said, pretty much, we can handle things by ourselves. We will control nature through our technology. This denial of God is the fundamental turning away and of what we refer to in Hebrew as avodah zarah, or idolatry. Obviously, by the sons of God, these fallen angels taking the daughters of men, our sages say they took from both single and married women. They had no concern or care for the boundaries and parameters of family. This was the creation of immorality, adultery. Bloodshed was common, as was theft. People had no respect for the boundaries and parameters of others that we remember was created by Cain. They said our powers will give us strength of hand to do what we want. And therefore, 4 significant violations were there. Idolatry, adultery, theft, murder. You could say, well, wait a second. Where in the Bible has it said that these things are against the law? Where does it say that these things were forbidden? You'll find that it does not say, does it? How then are the people to be held accountable for their behavior? And this brings us to the logical conclusion that obviously the people must have known right from wrong, good from bad. Where did they learn it? As we had taught previous, they learned it from Adam, who had brought with him knowledge, information, and even books from the Garden of Eden, which became the foundation of all humanity. This is what we call the universal laws for mankind, or we call the Sheva Mitzvot, the Seven Commandments. We refer to them today as the seven laws of the Bnei Noach, the children of Noah, because remember, everybody got wiped out other than Noah and his kids. But they had their source earlier, and it's clear and evident from the Bible that God's condemning people for violating these things, even though the Bible does not clearly spell out black and white that he commanded them these things. You're being condemned for something you can rest assured that the people knew that they weren't supposed to be doing them, and they had to have some knowledge. Remember, the Bible is not, and I'll say it a million times, is not a history book. It's not written by you and me according to collegiate standards by Western secular understandings of literature. It's not going to provide for you every detail about everything. No way, no how. But nonetheless, as we can see here, we can read through the lines what is by what is, if you will. Continuing, God saw the world was corrupted. The technologies that the angels brought had actually thwarted the purpose of creation. It not only contaminated humanity psychologically, it literally perverted even the genetic nature of animals, plants, of life itself on earth. Everything had become mutated. Everything had become perverted. The entire purpose of creation had been thwarted. There was no choice. It's interesting. Let me read the next verse here. God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me. The world is filled with man's crimes. I shall therefore destroy them with the earth." Where does it say the end of all flesh has come before me? What does that mean? Why does he just say, "I'm really angry at man, I'm going to kill him"? What is it, the end of flesh? It's like it's something tangible. Comes before God? God sees it? But that's exactly what this is. You see, God foresaw the inevitable outcome of the course of human events at that time. He saw the way mankind was going. They were polluting the earth. They were corrupt in their psychology. They were corrupt in their behavior. And everything was being done wrong. And ultimately, when everything is being done wrong, in the end, everything breaks down and collapses. God foresaw the course of action that man had chosen, and it was clear and inevitable that they were going to blow up the planet. God intervened, not as if so much to punish, as if to salvage what he could. He could have just wiped it all out, let them blow it up. That would have been too much trouble. He put in too much investment in here, if you will. So therefore, salvage operation. The world was full of man's crimes. Even the earth itself was. The physical earth. I'll destroy them from the earth. So now he commands Noah. Salvage operation. I'm going to save a select few. A chosen few that has not been corrupted. So that DNA, if you will, can survive. And we all know the famous story. God says to make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Cypress wood, some interpret it to be a type of a pine. Most of the rabbis are the interpretation that it was some type of a cedar wood. Divide the ark into compartments. Caulk inside and out with pitch. And this is how you construct it. The ark is supposed to be 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, 30 cubits high. What's a cubit? I don't know if any of you have ever heard a very funny comic skit done by the comedian Bill Cosby called Noah and the Lord. It was done a long, long time ago about a comical dialogue going on between God and Noah building the ark. It's actually very, very funny. What's a cubit? That's what Noah in his comedy skit asked God. Well, we actually know the answer. A cubit is approximately today 18 inches to 24 inches, a foot and a half to 2 feet. So the ark in its length was somewhere between 450 and 600 feet. Its width was somewhere about 75 to 100 feet. And its height was somewhere about 45 to 50 feet. A big, long, rectangular box. Almost, if you will, like a coffin. Interesting about this description here is that actually it is very floatable. The way and means of its physical structure means that it could be tossed and turned on the oceans and always it's going to like come out right, come up on the top. The commandment says, make a skylight for the ark. Make it slanted so that it is 1 cubit wide on top. Place the ark's door on its side and make a first, second, and third deck. The first deck was for Noah and his family and the supplies. The second deck was for the animals. And what do you think was down in the third deck? All the mess, all the leftover. Boy, oh boy, what a cleaning job that must have been. Now, it's an interesting teaching here. You're in this big old boat that's 450 to 600 feet long. And you have a little opening in the top, which he said is a cubit. A foot and a half to 2 feet wide? How on earth is that going to provide light for everything inside the boat 600 feet wide? All the more so for the second and third levels. Again, our Ben Uziel commentary, Aramaic translation of the Torah, the oldest one we have, brings down a very interesting telling here. He states that God guided Noah to one of the rivers emanating from the Garden of Eden. And from there he extracted a stone which glowed. And it was from this stone that he put into the levels of the ark, and they had illumination. What kind of stone was this? I couldn't begin to tell you. But in light of the fact that the angels of old taught men technologies, I wouldn't be surprised if this stone, in quotes, was some type of a technological illumination device, similar possibly to things we have today. Was it? Without seeing and examining it, I couldn't tell you exactly. But there is clearly implication that this could be true. Now, continuing, says God says, I am bringing the flood. Water shall be on the earth to destroy from under the heavens all flesh, having in it the breath of life. All that is on the land will die. Notice it doesn't say everything in the sea died. Aquatic life was not included in the ark. I will keep my pledge that you will come into the ark. You will be together with your sons, your wives, and your sons' wives. From all flesh, bring two of each kind into the ark to live with you. They shall be male and female. From each separate species of bird, from each separate species of livestock, from each separate species of land animal. Notice no fish. Bring to yourself two of each kind. Take with you all the food that will be eaten and keep it in storage, and it shall be food for you and the animals. Okay, that's a scenario that we know, all right? God did all, Noah did all that God commanded him. He did exactly. Now, how did these animals come into the ark? Ben Uziel states, the angels brought them. Remember, if you had fallen angels on the earth, you also had non-fallen angels on the earth, loyal angels. Something might tell me the two groups probably didn't get along and socialize together. But nonetheless, their presence was very active. We saw that with regards to Enoch, which wasn't that too far before this time now. The angels knew specifically which animals were not contaminated genetically. And those are the ones that they brought to the ark for Noah. All animals from the land, all animals from the air. There's a very profound tradition that's brought down as well. That even the demonic races who lived upon the earth were given access. access to the ark, and one of each of the demons were actually included and brought onto the ark as well. What on earth does that mean? I couldn't tell you. All I can tell you is that is the legend recorded way back when, from again this Enochian apocalyptic literature, which had its sources in the place of the Essenes and the Qumrans, mentioned these types of teachings. Very profound, and God only knows what it means. But the angels now, who chose specifically which animals to bring, knew exactly what they were doing, and brought everything to the ark in its time. Now, you can imagine, how long do you think it took Noah to build an ark? It must have taken him decades, possibly even generations. We're taught that while he did this in a secluded area, people were very well aware of what he was doing. And they asked him, "Hey, what are you doing?" "I'm building an ark," he said. "Uh-huh. Now, what do you think the persons on those days thought of Noah and his ark?" "God's going to send a flood and wipe out the earth." "Yeah, right." The people in those days claimed that they had what was necessary technologically to thwart the coming of the flood. Now, God says to Noah, "Come into the ark, you and your family. I've seen that you are righteous performing this generation." He says something. I'm going to get to the ark in a minute, but let me say something here. "Take 7 pairs of every clean animal, each consisting of a male and its mate. Of every animal that is not clean, take 2, male and its mate. The birds of the heaven, take 7 pairs, each consisting, male and its mate. Let them keep seed alive on face of all the earth. Because another 7 days, I'll bring rain onto the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. I will obliterate every organism that I made from the face of the earth." Clean and unclean animals? I thought that only came from Mount Sinai. What does Noah know about clean and unclean animals? Apparently, as we know from when he got off the ark, he made a sacrifice to God. 7 animals. We've seen this in another place, where if you remember Bilam, the evil one, who wanted to come and curse Israel, he said, "Make me 7 altars and I'll offer 7 sacrifices." So this is a significant and ancient teaching that Bilam obviously knew from these days, just like Noah did. Clean and unclean animals was clearly a known information in those days. Somebody had to have taught Noah what these clean and unclean species were. Way back when. More proof of there being knowledge not written in the text of the Bible. Moving along. God did all that Noah had commanded. Noah was 600 years old. The flood occurred. Waters was on the earth. Noah, along with his sons, his wives, his sons' wives, came into the ark ahead of the waters of the flood. It says here the specific order: Noah and his sons, his wife and his, Noah along with his sons, the males first and the females second. The implication was that there was to be no intimacies between husbands and wives during the time in the ark. We learn from this that at the time of great upheaval and apocalypse upon the earth, we are supposed to abstain ourselves from any types of intimacies of this nature, because it is just terribly incongruent with what's going on in the world. At the time of the destruction, we should not be involved in the act of creation. As it says, there's a time and a purpose for all things under heaven. The waters come. 7 days passed, the waters were on the earth. It's in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th of the month. We know that second month, first month is Tishrei, second month here being Cheshvan, 17th of Cheshvan. All the well springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened. Continued to rain on earth for 40 days and 40 nights. The water didn't just pour down from the sky, it rose up from the land. It is a known geological fact that we have underground oceans under our earth. Now, in light of our previous teachings about there being inner earth, There are tremendous amounts of oceans and all the different levels and all the different layers. God somehow did something which tipped the earth, if you will, enabling all those waters from beneath to pour up to the surface, causing and creating such upheaval that the skies also rained and poured, and of course created such a terrible flood, wiped everybody out. And as we very well know, Noah's telling of the tale of the flood is not the only recording of this in history. In ancient Babylonian writings, they have found the Epic of Gilgamesh, which speaks of this. Josephus speaks of earlier Greek writings that also spoke of the flood. So in those ancient days, knowledge of this ancient flood was not just considered a Bible tale. It was very well believed to have happened based upon historical occurrences or historical documents in numerous cultures across the known world. What caused the flood? What did God do? I once saw a rendering of exactly what supposedly happened. And allegedly what happened was that God sent I don't know if it was a comet, a meteor, or even another planet, which zoomed by the earth in very close proximity, upsetting the magnetic shift upon the planet, causing there to be a shift in even the orbit of the earth, the rotation of the earth, the axis of the earth, and literally tilted the earth off its foundations. And that's what caused this rupture from beneath and the complete change from above, where the waters just literally were ripped out of their basins and covered everywhere. The people of the generation said they had the technology to prevent this. Apparently, they believed that they could not necessarily prevent the coming of this meteor. The implication is that they saw it coming. They knew it was coming, but they considered it to be just a natural phenomena without anything to be concerned about, because they had the technology that could have somehow led to protect the earth. Guess what? They were wrong. Our rabbis say, in a very interesting choice of words, that God switched the angels over the different ruling powers on the earth, and therefore when they went to invoke the angels to change, the different angels were there, and their prayers went unheard. Practically speaking, what that means was, somehow, the people of the day believed that they had the technology, the secret, if you will, of the angels, to control. But God somehow thwarted them by subverting the laws of nature, possibly overturning them. We have learned and know from science that the magnetic pole of north and south upon the earth has flipped from north to south to north, sometimes with radical speed. What changes could that make upon the face of the earth, especially if and when some massive space body came by? It could literally mess up everything. And indeed, that's what happened. You see, as much as we consider ourselves to be masters of our own fate, rulers and lords of the earth, we are nothing of that at all. We definitely live in the middle of a very crowded universe. We are definitely in the middle of a real Star Wars. There are other races and entities involved here with mankind, and have been for a very long time. We're just pawns on the chessboard. And that is the reality of things. Those who turn to God can, if you will, take a step above and recognize what's really going on and are in touch with the King. But those who don't, well, they believe their fate is in their own hands, but we see reality is rather different. So moving right along, on the day that the war has started, somehow this natural apocalypse, I don't know what other better word to refer to it as, but that's really what it was. When this apocalypse occurred, Noah went into his shelter. Noah was ready. Noah was prepared. No one else was interested in listening because they put their faith in all their fallen angels and all their technologies, and it all failed them in the end. Came in with Shem, Ham, and Yefet, Noah's wives, and three sons with them. They came along with every separate kind of beast, every separate kind of livestock, every separate kind of land animal, every separate kind of living creature, every bird and every winged animal. Of all flesh that has in it a breath of life, they came to Noah, to the ark, two by two. Those who came were male and female. Of all flesh they came as God had commanded Noah, and God sealed them inside. Now, there is an ancient legend which states there were certain animals that left the earth, were taken either to inner earth or to other places, and that survived the flood, but not through the ark. One of them was a bird that's said to have lived like Adam for 1,000 years, and at the end of that time would go into its nest and somehow ignite itself, spontaneously combust in fire, burn itself down to dust, and then out of the dust would rise again and resurrect itself to life. This is a bird called the phoenix. Some might say, well, that's mythology. What does that have to do with the Bible and Judaism? Well, I don't know. All I can tell you is in the book of Job, in the 28th chapter, 19th verse, it states very clearly the existence of the phoenix, and that the reality of it says that actually the verse says, I will extend my days like the phoenix. I will go into my nest and I will revive and extend my days like the phoenix. It's kind of a translation of the verse. So the Bible speaks about the phoenix. What do you know? There's another animal, an interesting one. Our sages say that this animal only appeared in the days of Moses, that it was concealed since then. And from this animal that was offered as a sacrifice, its skins were used and taken for the Ark of the Covenant, to conceal and cover it as they traveled. This animal in the Bible is referred to as a tachash. Our rabbis say that the tachash had the image or form of a horse with a single horn in its forehead. We call it today a unicorn. A unicorn's skins covered the Ark of the Covenant? That is what our rabbis teach, yes. What about the other animals? Dinosaurs, dragons. Some say those were very much existing in the pre-Adamic days. And though they are mentioned, yes, dragons are also mentioned in the book of Job. Where and how and when? Well, for that we have to get into a discussion beyond the limitations of where we are now, and I'll reference you back to the reptilian angels who we spoke about specifically with relation to the Nachash, the serpent in the fall. So, the flood rose on the earth for 40 days. The waters increased, lifting the ark, and it rose from the ground. The waters surged and increased very much, and the ark began to drift on the surface of the water. The waters on the earth surged upward very, very much, and all the high mountains under the heavens were covered. The waters had surged upward 15 cubits, and all the mountains were covered. So about 45 to 60 feet above the highest mountains. That's how high the water was. And if the highest mountains were the Himalayas, and they're about 6 miles high, that's about how high the waters were. So even though it was just barely touching the tips of the mountains, lowlands were under miles and miles and miles of water. Only something of such great magnitude as what we described could literally rip out the oceans from their beds to cover things in this nature. All flesh that walked the earth perished. Birds, livestock, wild beasts, and every lower animal that swarmed on the earth, as well as every human being. Everything on dry land whose life was sustained by breathing died. It's an interesting choice of words, but true. Again, it doesn't speak about the fish now, does it? Actually, it's a very interesting mystical teaching from the Holy Zohar, which states that God correspondingly created everything on land and sea, as again, to correlate to one another. And just like you have a man that rules upon the land, so there is some type of sea creature that rules in the sea. We don't know exactly what that is. But when we look at certain types of mammals, aquatic mammals, dolphins, certain types of whales, killer whales, we find them to have very large brains, and they are very intelligent. And it would be very interesting if somehow we could ever break the language barrier between humans and these aquatic species and find some means of communication to see, A, if they're able to communicate, B, what they would have to communicate, because if they possessed any type of a knowledge, a history, as do we, what they could tell us would be radical. You could dismiss this and say, oh, come on, who knows? Only God placed his spirit in man. I agree, that's true. No dolphin or whale is created in the image of God. I agree, that's true. But that doesn't mean they don't have intelligence. That doesn't mean they don't have the ability of communication. And who knows, by communicating, where that would lead us. Maybe someday when mankind is rectified and we are again able to talk with the animals. Boy, what tales they might have to tell us. The flood thus obliterated every organism that had been on the face of the land. Humanity, livestock, land animals, and the birds of the heaven. Notice again, no mention of the fish. They were obliterated from the earth. And only Noah and those with him in the ark survived. So, there we are. The flood. What led to the flood? The corruption of the generation, where everything became so corrupted. God did not again wipe it all out. He chose a salvage plan. That's why he saved the animals, and that's why he saved Noah. He chose the cream of the crop and protected and saved them. Now, going back to that apocalyptic metaphor as it was in the days of Noah, so we are taught that before Mashiach comes, when there is to be an apocalypse upon the world, not that everybody is to be wiped out, but there is promised to be a remnant, a chosen select. And it will be their job to safeguard themselves, protect themselves, build, if you will, their own ark. No, don't go around now building a 600-foot boat in your backyard. But to learn from this the practicalities of what is necessary to survive in a very dangerous world environment like we have today. Indeed, as we will learn in our next lesson, God promised never to destroy the world again with a flood of water. But the prophecies have always stated that the end time apocalypse would be a flood, if you will, of fire. And indeed, the prophecies state, there's an ancient tradition brought down by our rabbis about the final war called Gog and Magog, recorded in the Christian tradition is called Armageddon. Our rabbis teach a tradition that this war would last for only 12 minutes. And during that 12 minutes, one-third of the world would be destroyed. One-third would be devastated, but salvageable, and only one-third would get out without harm. What could cause such a devastation in 12 minutes? If we read the book of Joel, and the prophecy given there, where it said there would be signs in the heavens, blood, fire, pillars of smoke. The words pillars of smoke, timrat ashan in Hebrew, is very revelatory about the nature of these pillars. You see, the word for pillar in Hebrew is timra. A timra is the word for a palm tree. Now, if you look at a palm tree, it's a very long, thin, stem that goes up, trunk, very thin trunk that goes up, and then branches out on top in almost like a hanging circular shape. One of my students, when I shared with them, says, oh, you mean kind of like a mushroom? And I said, yeah, a cloud in the shape of a mushroom combined with fire, combined with blood, that in 12 minutes could wipe out a third of the earth. Gee, I wonder what that could mean. Well, being that that's outside of the parameters of our present discussion, I'm not going to get into it. I've discussed these types of teachings in their place, and that's not here. But on that note, due to our time, I'm going to conclude, and Be'ezrat Hashem, God be willing, we'll pick up in our next lesson with the remainder of the flood and the repopulation of the earth. Baruch Adonai lo'olam, amen ve'amin.